tonight on Arena. Thomas Vinterberg on his Oscar-winning film Another Round, and Billy O'Hanlon and Jane Clark on the importance of place in their writing. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Filmmaker Thomas Vinterberg is by now a stalwart of European cinema, founding more than a quarter of a century ago the Dogma 95 movement, along with fellow cinephiles like Lars von Trier. Vinterberg is best known for films like Festen and The Hunt, but his most recent offering, Another Round, has been a massive critical and box office success in Denmark. Not only that, it won the Oscar for Best International Feature Film at this year's Academy Awards. Another Round tells the story of four bored middle-aged men who experiment with casual drunkenness with, has to be said, varying degrees of failure. The film stars Mads Mikkelsen as Martin, who is depressed in his teaching job and in search of some way to remind himself of his glorious youth. But more than just being a film about society's complex relationship with alcohol, Another Round becomes a meditation on masculinity, on our relationship with ourselves, with the reality of our lives, and about how we come to terms with the failures we face along the way. Film opens here in Ireland this Friday, and I'm delighted to be joined this evening by Thomas Vinterberg. Thomas, you're very welcome to the programme. And in terms of this film, was there something about your home country's relationship with alcohol that was particularly compelling to you?
Well, definitely. My country have been great drinkers at all times, all the way since we were Vikings. It's an interesting country, this one, because we're a bit like a modest shire of hobbits, and yet sometimes we transform into crazy drunk Vikings. So we have an interesting drinking culture, such as you guys, I guess.
Mm. It's interesting that you use the term great drinkers. That sounds like an adjective of praise.
Oh, yeah. This project started as a celebration of drinking, basically. But we very quickly realized that making a movie about alcohol must also contain a story about the dark sides of drinking. The fact that this destroys families and lives all over the world, all the time. But more so, we ended up wanting to make a movie about living as opposed to just existing. And that's what became important to us.
There's a very interesting scientific theory that is expounded in the film. A Norwegian theorist, I believe, Finn Skårderud, if that is somewhere close to pronunciation of his name. Is this a real scientific theory, first of all, and how much credence does it hold within the academic and scientific community?
It's a real scientist. That's how far we'll go. It's not in the world of academia, it's not considered a theory. It's just something he said, basically.
And give me the basis of that.
Well, he says that the humankind should have been born with a little bit of alcohol in the blood to make people more creative, courageous, open-minded, and less self-aware, I guess.
And these are some of the qualities that the four teachers at the very heart of the film's story, that they go about exploring. How far can they push themselves in terms of their drinking all day, every day? But the idea is that they never quite get drunk, but they never quite get sober either.
Exactly. There is this point which we claim is at 0.5 or 0.5, as you say, where you just open up, basically. You're not drunk, you're not sober, you're present, and you're at your best. And we know this feeling from endless boring conversations that suddenly turn interesting after a couple of glasses of wine. People leave the self-awareness, people leave the secure road and start putting things at risk at that time. And that's the path they're trying to find, definitely.
Yeah, and you also quote leaders from the past who seem to have managed to work at that level of sobriety and drunkenness some of the times. Churchill is in there, Roosevelt is in there. Interestingly enough, Hitler is not anywhere near the bad drinking that both Churchill and Roosevelt maybe display.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think with fearfulness about what would have happened if he had a couple of schnapps every morning. But Churchill, we looked at a lot. The decision of sending a couple of 100,000 civilians into war in fisher boats is probably a decision he made after a couple of glasses of champagne, Paloschia, whatever he was drinking. And I've been asking myself and my co-writer Tobias Lindholm many times, what would have happened if he was sober? Would he have made this irrational but still brilliant decision? I think drinking has informed a lot of things that have happened in world history.
It's quite a big claim, but you do give us some real life footage of leaders clearly in a state of slightly tipsy as they're making speeches. Boris Yeltsin being one in there for sure, and there's a history of a well-known story of that in this country as well. But coming back to your characters and your actors that are involved here as well, did you test out Mr. Skardarud's theory? Because creativity, after all, is something that you need to be a little bit open for it to happen.
Well, the actors here are first-class actors, so they can act drunk. But before shooting this movie, we had a booze boot camp, so to speak, where we did a couple of weeks of rehearsal trying to nail this thing, because it had to be nailed. They had to be convincingly drunk. And obviously, they couldn't be drunk on a 12-hour shoot in front of children driving cars and stuff like that. So at that time, we rehearsed, they drank, I filmed them, they were teachers to each other on different levels of inebriation and stuff like that. So we digged very deeply, but we worked hard to play drunk, basically.
What about what you explore in the film as well? Because our four teachers are essentially, they range from 40 up, I'm guessing, to somewhere near to 50, maybe a little bit above 50, the four men who are teachers together. But we're also dealing with basically the end of secondary school here and that rite of passage, which in Denmark, or certainly according to your film, a bit like this country, it involves a lot of drinking.
I think the teenagers and the middle-aged men are both in each their own end of a strongly controlled performance culture where everything is evaluated constantly. As a teenager, you're evaluated at school, you're evaluated on social media 40 times a day. And there's an element of self-awareness that makes the young people historically unhappy, and which I think urges them to drink, because they need this element of the uncontrollable, being allowed to fail and to do things that, to misbehave, basically. Whereas my generation, they are in an urge to put things at risk, to regain the element of curiosity and to get out of the treadmill, basically. So it's nuances of the same thing, though it's two different generations. This is a film that is rebelling against the element of over-control and performance culture, and is rebelling for the element of the uncontrollable, basically.
Thomas, thanks for speaking with us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Thomas Vinterberg speaking to us about his film Another Round, which opens in Irish cinemas this Friday, July the 2nd.
13 minutes past 7 on Tuesday night's Arena. Deirdre Sullivan is a writer and teacher from Galway. She's written 7 acclaimed books for young adults, including Savage Her Reply, Perfectly Preventable Deaths and Tangleweed and Brine. She won the Children's Book of Ireland Award in the year 2018 and the An Post Irish Book Award for Young Adults in 2020. Her latest collection of short stories, I Want to Know That I Will Be Okay, is her first book for adults and is published by Banshee Press. And delighted to have Deirdre join us on the programme this evening. I suppose that first question has to be around this shift into a different register, if that's what happens when you started to write these stories. Was it a conscious move, Deirdre, or were these stories bubbling away in the background while you were writing your other very successful books for children and young adults?
The stories in this collection, some of them would be older than others. The oldest one is A Scream Away From Someone. I think that's around 7 years old. But it was always something I did kind of while I was working on big projects. I like to have something that's just for me to kind of remind me of why I write. Because when you're working on a novel, there are moments where you get stuck or you become kind of, you know, frustrated or resentful. And I write because I love to write. And having short fiction or something that didn't have the, I suppose, the pressure of a contract or a deadline was really beneficial for me.
And were you aware, or was it a conscious decision that it would be the potential readership for these stories would be an older audience? Were you aware of that while writing them? And did that give you something else in terms of your writing muscles?
Absolutely. I would have sent them out to different literary journals like Banshee Press, the Dublin Review. The first piece of short fiction I had published was in the Irish Times on the website. And I definitely did look at them as something that was for an adult audience rather than for teenagers.
And somebody described the collection to me today. You know, the word visceral is bandied about quite a bit, but in terms of the way you write about the body and the female body in particular and the functions of the female body in this collection, visceral is the best word to describe it.
Yeah, bodies are quite visceral, and I think a lot of the grooming and a lot of the maintenance that is expected of women is quite uncanny when you take a step back and look at it with fresh eyes. And there's a gruesomeness to it.
Yeah, the expectation is quite interesting. I'm thinking in particular there of a story called Hen, and it's about a hen party essentially, or there's a hen party at the heart of it. But the narrator in this story comes across a hare in the shower where there shouldn't be a hare. It's not her hair and it's not her partner's hair. It's somebody else's hair. But she seems to be constantly aware, as do other narrators in various stories, she seems to be constantly aware of trying to make herself in some way physically perfect or physically acceptable to her partner, working that she feels she'll never be good enough.
I think that is something that is quite relatable to a lot of people. I mean, if you only kind of have to look at all the different products that are available in Boots to kind of refine pores and smooth skin and all of that. I think every time you become aware of something like that, it's like another little question mark. Oh, should I be refining my pores? Should I be using primer? You know, kind of. And all these things, all these messages do niggle away at you. And it's not like, it's not something I'm obsessed with, but it's something I question, and I write to explain the world to myself and to answer things I can't explain.
It's there as well. It's not only the products and Boots and other pharmacists and advertising on television that causes difficulty for some young women in particular. The mother-daughter relationship seems to be quite a difficult one in many of the stories, in particular in Her Face. Maybe tell us a little bit about the story there of the estrangement between this mother and daughter and the whys of that estrangement.
Her Face is a story about a woman who is driving her car and she thinks she sees her mother, and it brings up all kinds of memories because they're not speaking. And it's that thing of no matter you can't cut away your mother. You know, kind of the umbilical cord is cut, but there's a connection. There are tendrils of the people that you come from in you that you cannot sever, no matter how much you want to. And the narrator in her face struggles with that and struggles with maintaining a relationship with her father when she does not want to speak to her mother.
And indeed, the opening story in the collection as well, The Mother, with that title, obviously mother is an issue here as well. But Leisha and Jim are getting, they're recently married, the couple at the centre of the story. They're getting the pressure of some of their pals who were married around the same time have had a first child. Some of them have even had a second child. But in the case of Leisha and Jim, that is not the situation. The solution that Jim comes up with is the most surreal and unexpected solution. Certainly, I was not expecting this. The clinic that Jim finds, tell me about it.
So essentially, they in the world of the mother, there's a process by which a woman can give birth to an animal of her or her family's choosing. So you can have like a panda or a puppy or a guinea pig or a little sloth. If you don't feel ready for a child, but you'd quite like to, you know, kind of be pregnant and, you know, have something to nurture.
I love the way you say that so matter-of-factly, that, well, you know, in this world, you can, you know, a woman can give birth to a panda or a sloth or whatever animal she chooses. A kind of an idea like that, when it arrives into your imagination, because I'm presuming it's not based on any real clinic in the world, when something that comes flying into your imagination, is it a frightening aspect in terms of thinking, I'm going to have to write this down now and try to work it into a story, or is it exciting?
It actually came from, like, when you kind of, you do, like, as a woman in the world, like, when you're at a certain age, the pressure for kids starts happening. And I kind of would always say to people, oh, it's not a puppy, like, you know, it's a big decision. And then I was like, what if it was a puppy, though? Be a bit easier, would it? You know,
so it was kind of an exciting prospect, and you just ran with the surreal aspect of that.
Yeah, I just wanted to take the idea for a walk, and I had a lot of fun doing it.
For a walk, that they, so you give birth to the story and took it, yes, like for a walk, like Leisha and Jim do with their dog that they get. The supernatural, I think, as well, Deirdre, is very present throughout the story, throughout the stories. In the story called All That You Possess, I said, oh, this is fine. Yeah, I was in a fairly real world for a while, where I had Ella, a little 3-year-old with an imaginary friend called Pebbles. But Pebbles is a 400-year-old squirrel. Now, I'm wondering if there's a woman in front of me who perhaps is a younger woman or a young girl, had a 400-year-old squirrel as a friend or some kind of similar imaginary friend.
I used to babysit a child when I was in my teens who had two imaginary friends, and they would threaten to eat her toes at night. And I thought that was quite, like, and she would also use them to get away with stuff. And it was very, like, it was very sweet at the time, but yeah, I kind of started thinking about it. And when you're telling, you know, kind of when you're thinking about it out loud, like, there's these creatures that exist only in her head or only she can see, that, like, cause her to behave badly and threaten to hurt her. And then you kind of, like, I wanted to revisit that. And I was kind of quite interested as well in the story of Jeff the mongoose, who, I think it was in the 40s on an island off the coast of Britain, but he appeared to a family and haunted them for the best part of a decade. And it was kind of one of these unexplained things, but he was a mongoose, but he didn't look like a mongoose. And he would say things like, you know, I have hands and I have feet, I'll never die. And that he was living in the walls, and that he was and I thought that was really interesting. And I kind of read a lot about Jeff and kind of merged him with Pebbles a little bit. And I think, kind of, as a parent, one of the scariest things would be to have your child get sick or have your child to be unwell. And, you know, there are illnesses that we can see, and then there are illnesses that sneak up on us. And, like, I've kind of talked about tendrils before, but, like, those little tendrils of Pebbles kind of weaving their way through Ella's brain is something that her mother is powerless to stop, and it's kind of happening slowly but also all at once.
Yeah, well, it's funny now that that idea of the tendril and the idea of something kind of having a hold over a person is there, and that supernatural aspect. I just want to explore what you're doing, what was in your mind in another story again, where the supernatural is present. A young girl who's living with her, it's a great aunt, in fact, that she's with, isn't she? Because her mother and father are off fixing their marriage, is what we're told, I think. But there's a kind of supernatural well and a supernatural being from that well. Did you find the sort of things, you know, that kind of fantastical thing, I think probably fits quite easily into young adult fiction. Did you have to work it differently to work it into fiction that you thought might be read by an older readership?
Not really. There is a great tradition of supernatural fiction, and a lot of writers have dabbled with it, and, you know, kind of, like, if you're looking at, like, Irish writers in the uncanny, kind of, there'd be, like, Dorothy McArdle. There'd be, like, I think Maeve Brennan's The Visitor is such a, like, I mean, it's not a supernatural novel per se, but it's got that sense of dread permeating through it. And it's very, I found it a very stressful read. And it's that kind of, I suppose, I like to take the things that are worrisome in real life and then just to push them a little bit further. And see where that takes me.
And that's obviously where you're pushing those supernatural things as far as you can. I want to finish up with the story. There's something beautiful about this story, even in its title, The Bockety Woman. Now it has a rather a twist that I don't want to get into towards the end, but perhaps you might explain this Bockety Woman, and in fact the wonderful example of womanhood that she turns out to be.
That's actually so interesting and quite touching that you've chosen that story, because it's based loosely, but it is based on a real person who would have supported my grandfather when he was a little guy, and he did lose his mother to Spanish flu, and she would have stayed with them. They both got sick, and this woman, Delia, I should probably explain, she was, she had a disability. She couldn't walk properly, so they brought her from the workhouse to help out around the house and to help with the children, and she kind of found ways to do that and to excel at that in spite of the challenges that she faced. And they both got sick with the Spanish flu, but Delia would have survived and my great-grandmother would have died. And when my great-grandmother was dying, she would have said to Delia, take care of the children, take care of the children. And she did, and she stayed, and she minded them. And we remember her very fondly in my family.
Well, that's beautiful that you've honoured her then in the story in the way that you do. And I don't want to go into the ending of the story, because that's something that people can get when they get to read the book. But lovely to speak with you this evening, Deirdre. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Deirdre Sullivan there. And the new collection of stories that she has written is called I Want to Know That I Will Be Okay. It's published by Banshee Press. 28 minutes past seven on Tuesday night's Arena. I think it's fair to say that the landscapes of Ireland, from the sea to the shore to the bog and the drumlin, have been a source of inspiration for many of our writers and artists, from John Banville's novel The Sea to Kavanagh's poem about the stony grey soil and Evan Boland's suburb of Dundrum. Writers have transformed place into imaginative space. And the Dublin Book Festival, in a special summer series called Departures, is offering a three-part limited series of conversations between writers, along with music filmed in some of our most beautiful locations in Ireland. The journey begins in Macredon in County Wicklow, moving across to Westport in County Mayo, and finishing in Cove in County Cork. And joining me this evening are the point of departure and the point of arrival of those three journeys. Two of the participants, Billy O'Callaghan, who'll be talking to us about Cove and County Cork for sure, and Jane Clark, who'll be talking to us about Macredon in County Wicklow. In fact, Jane, you described the series to us, I think in some ways you could give us a sense of what's involved here. Your conversation is between yourself, the presenter is Manco McGann, and the nature writer Michael Feuer. Where did this conversation start out, and what places did you start talking about?
Well, Moncon McGann, as you know, he lives in Westmeath, so he's very interested in the Midlands. So he was, because I suppose I have two landscapes, Sean, the Roscommon, where I lived till I was 17, and then here in Glenmalure, where I'm living for the last 30 years. So, you know, he was talking about the contrast between those landscapes. And then with Michael, we were looking at, you know, the role of the nature writer and how the nature writer helps us, all the rest of us, look differently at what's around us. You know, so the nature writer is a kind of a guide to the landscape.
Jane telling us there, Billy, that she has two landscapes, Roscommon, I suppose her native landscape, if you like, and Wicklow. I presume a Cork man could only ever have one landscape.
Yeah, we only need one. one is plenty.
How important would you say then the landscape of where you grew up and in and around Cork and County Cork is to you, Billy, as a writer as much as anything else?
Yeah, I mean it's hugely important. It's you know, it's the foundation, I suppose, really. You know, it shapes the characters that we like to write about, or that I like to write about. It often shapes the story, the actual plot, because the story, sometimes the stories can only be written in a certain setting, you know, so the setting is as alive as, hopefully, as the characters are.
Well, let's go, Jane, if we get a sample of something here, it might give us a sense of something to bring that, what Billy's talking about, a little bit further. We'll go back to the native landscape and a Roscommon poem, The Suck, the river you're talking about here, and it's from your first collection, The River. Will you read the poem for us, Jane?
I will indeed. And just to say, Sean, there's a word in at the bottoms, which is the low-lying fields beside a river that tend to flood. Okay, the suck. Sometimes together, most often alone, we'd slip the catch on the rusted chain, follow the cart track through the bottoms. The river held our stories. It was where we'd go to talk or cry or be quiet in the company of the current. Whether it flowed fast after a flood, rolled in circling eddies, or drifted smooth and slow past stands of alder and silver green willow. We could look as far as the next bend or out to the island, speckled with yellow iris, bordered with sedge. We could dream of leaving, making lives of our own, ask the river to bless us. Let us go.
And that's Jane Clark reading her poem, The Suck, from her first collection, The River. And Jane, along with Billy O'Callaghan, is part of the upcoming series, which we're talking about this evening, Departures, featuring, I suppose, writers and their places and their spaces. Really, as I listen to the poem there, Jane, it strikes me how much it starts out kind of being a poem about a river, if you like, but very quickly it moves into an imaginative space rather than a simple description of where you are and what you're doing there.
Yeah, I suppose that's it. The landscape, it brings together the inner and the outer, you know, the inner world of the poet, and then how that's reflected, or how the landscape influences how you experience your inner world. You know, so I suppose this poem is really about separation and the moving away from home, the necessary separation of growing up. So, you know, that walk down to the river allowed me to write about that.
And of course, even choosing a river as the title for that first collection, you know, you're already giving us the idea that, yes, there's the source and it flows through that early part of whatever is happening to the river. But eventually it does have to move on and go off out into the sea. So there's a big metaphor there. Immediately you start to even write a collection like that.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, rivers are, they're steadfast and they're ever-changing. So, of course, they're a wonderful metaphor for our experience of life as well, and about growing up and growing older. But again, it wasn't that I thought, oh, that's a good metaphor.
Yeah. It came after the event.
It came after the work, the writing.
I wonder what way that is in terms of writing, in the writing of prose, Billy, because, you know, if you have landscape in a novel, for example, you're going to have to do a lot more, or you're possibly going to have to do a bit more of a descriptive aspect to it to give a sense of that to the reader, to create this sense of space. Does it serve a different function, do you think, in prose than it might do in poetry?
I suppose it does. I mean, it was interesting just listening to Jane there, because the idea of the actual landscape and the sort of the inner landscape. My most recent novel is called Life Sentences, which came out earlier this year. Mm. And it's based in the village of Douglas, which is where I grew up. It's based on my grandmother, her father and his mother coming from Cape Clear to settle eventually in Douglas. And, Douglas, if you know the place at all, has changed unbelievably in my lifetime. The Douglas of when I was a child is hardly the Douglas of now. It's, it's all shopping centres and, traffic jams. But at the same time, if I walk down the village, I can still see the village as it was when I was a boy going to school, holding my mother's hand, that sort of a way. So you hold on to it inside, and it becomes part of the stories that you're telling. You have to, you have to use the description where you can, but there's a bit of balancing involved, I suppose.
I think you might have you a short section for us that you might read for us, Billy? Is it from Life Sentences?
It is. It's just a short passage, and this book is narrated by three different characters, and this particular character is Nancy, who would have been based on my great-great-grandmother. So this is, she's in 1911, she's remembering when she left Cape Clear, 50 years earlier. So I'll just read a little passage. When I was a child, my mother often told me that we'd been 100 generations on Clear Island, one branch or another of us. And on the day the last one of us left, the island would sink out of grief to the bottom of the sea. And at 16, as I sat in the prow of the Sullivan brothers' boat, wanting more than anything to risk a backward glance, those words kept me afraid. For the entire crossing, my mother's voice sang loud inside me, and so truthful sounding that, had I turned my head, I felt sure I'd see the cliffs crumbling in on themselves, and their blankets of gorse and heather flushing the stony grey water with shades of purple and pink and gold. And worse still, that there'd be scatterings of my dead watching after me from the strand, tin-shouldered and forlorn, knowing I'd never return, that this was the end. Unclear, I knew the faces in every doorway and the family names that occupied every plot of graveyard earth. I knew the slopes and climbs of the fields where the best berries grew and where the ground birds nested. And I never slept a single night without the sighing of the running waves.
Billy, that there's such a beautiful image that you create there. I was in that place. I was with you there. But the line that jumped out of me, the island would sink out of grief into the bottom of the sea. That's an amazing thought and an amazing image and an amazing story. And it makes the landscape become a character in and of itself, which I think is quite extraordinary. And Jane Clark, coming back to you on that, I mean, we've heard, I suppose, the idea of metaphor with you. We get the sense of a real character in Billy's reading there. When the writer that was with you and Mancon on the day talking about Michael Feuer, talking about he's a nature writer. What aspect did he bring to the table, would you say?
Well, he brought his perspective. For example, he was talking to us about the dipper. It's that wonderful bird that can walk underwater. And, it's in lots of our rivers, but lots of Irish people don't even know about it. And he was saying, look, we've got wonders here that are as spectacular as what you'd find in the Galapagos. And it was just, that was just so important to look at that. And he said, down the road from me and where he lives in Rathfarnham, there's nature that's as spectacular as any place in the world. And, so that was the kind of thing that Michael was bringing to the discussion.
Yeah, and I suppose it's just different aspects of it, and that's why the series Departures has so much to it. There's also music involved in the various events as well. But your particular film, Jane, will be showing from July the 6th Yourself and Michael Fiora and Mancon McGann and the Wicklow Mountains is one of the locations there from the latter part of your life is what you'll be dealing with in that. Yours, yeah. Billy, will be on July the 20th. Yourself and Alice Taylor, in fact, will be involved there. And in the middle, there'll be Mayo with the writer Mike McCormack and the poet Alice Kinsel. That's July the 13th. But they all involve music, and I'll finish up by going to the music that, in fact, is there as part of Billy's film, which will be streamed on July the 20th, as I said, beginning in Cove in County Cork. And it's Jack O'Rourke, and Jack O'Rourke is here with Aisling Fitzpatrick on cello. And the song that's involved is Sea Swimming.
Martha took her time like the perfect crime. Pale toes listen on cool water, caressing little waves and drowning sin, confessing raw desire and diving in. I made a beeline for the brine, didn't think of the ice cold, healing all that pain in green and blue. Me and Martha, sun coming through.
And the beautiful sound of the sea to finish it all up. Jack O'Rourke there on vocals and piano, and he was accompanied by Aisling Fitzpatrick on cello. Sea Swimming, the song, and that will be part of Departures. You'll see it and hear more from Jack and Aisling on that with Billy O'Callaghan and Alice Taylor on July the 20th. Before that, July the 13th, Mike McCormack and poet Alice Kinsella will be talking about Mayo. And Departures begins on July the 6th with Jane Clark and Michael Fiora in the Wicklow Mountains. And thanks so much to Jane Clark and Billy O'Callaghan for being with us this evening. By the way, I forgot to say at the end of that last item, Departures, that we were speaking about, it's all coming from Dublin Book Festival, and you can find out full details of how to watch those various streaming events on dublinbookfestival.com. Now, singer, songwriter, composer and producer Scott Walker was one of the most acclaimed musicians of his era, rising to prominence originally as a member of the Walker Brothers. His 1967 debut album, Scott, cemented his reputation as a uniquely charismatic recording artist. He died just 2 years ago, 2019, was described by the BBC as one of the most enigmatic and influential figures in rock history. And yet, it could be argued that he never achieved the starry commercial success of many of his late 1960s contemporaries. So to answer our oft-asked Tuesday night question, where do I begin with? I'm joined by Zara Hederman to look at the career and legacy of Scott Walker. You know, one of the most enigmatic and influential figures in rock history, as the BBC said, Zara. But in many ways, he's the singer's singer. He's the artist's artist. He holds that status rather than any huge commercial success of compared to some of his contemporaries. Why do you think he has the status of that, you know, the artist's artist, the singer's singer, the writer's writer?
Yeah, absolutely. Good evening, Sean. I think he has that status because not only is his voice just such an iconic presence in every song that he does, but I think what people really love about Scott Walker is that he completely rejected commercial success for his artistic integrity and for autonomy. And he went from, as you said, in the 1960s, the poster boy of the pop scene, and especially orchestral pop, to someone who went quite reclusive, very little was ever really heard from him in between albums and in the 70s and the 80s. And when he did reemerge in the 90s, it was quite a shock that his fans got with the extreme avant-garde and modernist music he was coming out with. But he had people like, say, Brian Eno and Radiohead and Pulp throughout the years always bigging him up. Actually, David Bowie was a huge Scott Walker fan. And there's so many brilliant quotes from Bowie about Scott Walker. Particularly one of who knows anything about Scott Walker. That's just the kind of mystery and the magic that surrounds him. He seems like such an accessible character, and yet there is that kind of cheeky twinkle in his eye and his voice that holds your attention.
Yeah, even the name Scott Walker sounds like the fellow who lives around the corner type of thing, but Scott Walker wasn't even his name.
No, no, indeed. So he was born Noel Scott Engel, and he changed his name in 1964 after meeting John Mouse and Gary Leeds, who are probably better known as John Walker and Gary Walker. And they adopted the Walker surname to kind of present that really wholesome, familial image of the 1960s, to kind of echo like the Everly Brothers and the Righteous Brothers. But actually, when he tried to step out of the shadow of the Walker Brothers and step out of the Walker name, he actually released Scott 4, which is his, I would regard, his greatest body of work. It's his 1969 album. He originally released that as Scott Engel. That album as well was completely full of self-penned songs, and to this day it baffles me to think why that album was such a failure.
Yeah, well, let's just hold off on the album Scott Engel, or the album Scott 4 for the time being, because maybe we should listen to what it was that he had to, the shadow that was cast so long over him. I don't even have to say what the name of the song is from the Walker Brothers. Let's have a listen. And that's the Walker Brothers and The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore. And Zarda Hedeman with us this evening, asking the, and answering the question, where do I begin with Scott Walker? For sure, Zara, that's a huge commercial success. Was that part of the shadow that he had to step out from under, it, as you put it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, when that song came out initially, that was written by Bob Crewe and Bob Gaudio, and it was a single for Frankie Valli the year before, in 1965. But when the Walker Brothers released this song, the success of this song made the profile of the Walker Brothers so big that there was a point where the membership of their fan club surpassed the Beatles. And actually, when the Walker Brothers came to Dublin to play a show here, the fandom and the frenzy that surrounded the Walker Brothers ended up where the band, they were in their car after the show, and their fans turned the car upside down, and the guards had to kind of help them get the car back on tracks.
Well, that's very interesting, because I'd like to ask Brona, who texted into us to say that she loved him and saw him in the Adelphi twice in the 1960s. Was she anywhere near either of those cars? I sincerely hope not, Brona.
I hope not.
But we get a sense. I mean, obviously, Brona remembering that, you know, that one of those gigs, or still two of those gigs, and remembering them very clearly and very well. But no, the group did break up after that, you know, for whatever the reason was. And then we get Scott Walker, and a side of him which I think had been there all along, this love of music theatre and sort of more theatrical songs. He had a great love of Jacques Brel.
He did, yeah. Jacques Brel would be a hugely important figure for Scott Walker in particular. His songs would be sprinkled across the four Scott albums between 67 and 60 and six, or three Scott albums from 67 and 68. And I think what is really impressive about Scott Walker and Jacques Brel is that I think the Brel's riskiness and the bawdiness of his lyrics really helped Scott kind of tap into that kind of cheeky and playful nature with his lyrics, but it also really brought out the performer in him. You know, you have songs like Matilde, Jackie, Next, that you cannot think of Scott Walker and not think of the Jacques Brel songs as well.
Well, let's have a little listen. Listen to the beginning of Matilde.
You see what I see, on your knees and pray for me, Matilda's come back to me. Charlie, don't want another beer, tonight I'm gonna drink my tears, Matilda's come back to me. Go ask the maid if she heard what I said, tell her to change the sheets on the bed, Matilda's come back to me.
Yeah, the risque lyrics are there for sure in Matilda. Now, the lyrics of Jacques Brel, the translation of the lyrics of Jacques Brel and Scott Walker there with that solo version of Matilda and what needs to be done with the sheets and the bed because Matilda's back in town, as it were. But that's interpretation, Zara Hederman, that we're dealing with there. What about writing and his own process of writing? Was that as straightforward as his clear love of, and cheekiness in that interpretation of Brel's music?
Yeah, well, a part of why the Walker Brothers disbanded initially was because Walker became a songwriter for them. He would write the B-sides to their singles as a way to get publishing. And he steadily slipped into the role of songwriter quite quickly. His lyrics, for me, I think they're fascinating because he can so easily shift between very romantic and wistful to then really delving into the kind of darker aspects of life, like death. There's also quite a lot of very interesting political themes in his songs.
Now I'm going to let you talk about Scott Four that you were keen to talk about, and Scott Engel, and maybe that Engel name tells us something as well. The Old Man's Back Again, dedicated to the neo-Stalinist regime. Politics at play here for sure, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So this song is kind of like a fever dream of sorts of Stalin coming back and looking at the Czech government who have been kind of overthrown in this imagining. You also get within the song's arrangements a kind of Russian choral. And this is something in 1969, you know, the post-war pop song that just wasn't really done. He was hypercritical of regimes. He was kind of very open about his communist and leftist leanings, which I don't think at the time did him very many favours.
Yeah.
But as we hear on this song, it's just sublime, the kind of the journey he takes you on.
I've seen a hand, I've seen a vision, it was reaching through the clouds to risk a dream. The shadow crossed the sky and it crushed it to the ground, just like a beast. The old man's back again. The old man's back again. I seen a woman.
And that's Scott Walker and The Old Man's Back Again from Scott Four, or Scott Engel, as the album might have been called, maybe should have been called, given that kind of Marxist and very left-siding, left-leaning aspect to his politics, Zara Hederman. But you want to finish up, I know, with the Walker Brothers getting back together and The Electrician. And I have to say, nothing could prepare you in what we've listened to so far for the sound that we're going to get on The Electrician.
No, this song is, I would say, one of my favourites of all time. And I think for someone coming to Scott Walker completely fresh, I remember the first time hearing it and I was really blown away by it. It follows on from that political leaning. This is exceptionally dark. It's very stark. Mm. It has Hitchcock-like strings that build suspense. But then it also erupts and returns to that familiar swell of sophisticated orchestration, and was a really great indication of where his career would go later on in the 90s and thereafter.
All right, well, let's finish with a little bit of The Electrician. Thanks for speaking with us this evening, Zara.
Through the dark hip falls, screaming, are you mumbles? Kill me and kill me and kill me. If I turn the handle, you'll die in your dreams. Jerk the handle, you thrill me and thrill me and thrill me.
There we go, from the Walker Brothers reunion album from 1978, The Electrician, and you can hear where Bowie might have got some of his sounds from in the midst of all of that, can't you? Zara Hederman speaking to us this evening about the career of Scott Walker. And on a point of clarification, Your Honour, Brona has been back in touch, not near the Cars at all at the Adelphi in 1960 that we were talking about earlier on. Brona had to get the bus home, and she tells us that Scott Walker supported Roy Robinson first time, topped the bill second time. Thanks for that information, Bruno. But that is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.